session number 27185, Reel 4.
Major Barras, Reel 4.
I think you were saying that you at that time, you were not aware of there being defensive positions, but you thought that at higher levels, formation level, they must have had defence plans.
Oh, I'm sure they must have done. I mean, these were defensive positions, so presumably they had a plan to man them. Knowing full well, of course, that what I've since heard is Plan D, which was the advance into Belgium, was in fact what they were going to do in the event.
What was your daily routine of life like then when you were engaged in these works at Gauchon and at Meerschaum? Was there a routine working day?
Well, it was. It was outside the whole time, really. I mean, we used to go out there in the morning. We'd take, I suppose we took haversack rations with us. And then we just stay out there the whole day. And so far as the officers were concerned, it was a terribly boring time because once you'd allocated all the work to be done and then walked around and seen now and again to see if everybody was doing what they should have done or helping with any problems they had, there was hardly anything for an officer to do except stand around and either get wet or cold according to the meteorological conditions. And then we stayed out there all day. And you were very grateful to get it if you had a hot bath. I don't know, I can't remember whether I haven't got a hot bath in the evening, but you were very grateful to get into bed. It was a very tiring business. I mean, I know standing around sounds pretty idle, but if you've been standing around in the cold all day, you feel when you get into the warm, your eyes start closing up and you want to go to bed. So there wasn't an awful lot we did.
How did you arrange the feeding?
Well, in some of these places we were in, we weren't in too many actually, about two or three. The town was split up in various villages. They weren't all together in the same town, so that they were responsible for their own feeding. So they had their own cooks.
So this would be what, company level feeding?
Company level feeding, yes. So you'd have that. You'd have their own cooks there, their own cooking utensils and whatnot. Then they get the rations, and it really would depend on the some officer, probably the second in command of the company, would be in charge of the feeding, rations and cooking and menu and so forth, and it would be up to him and the cooks between them as to what they drummed up for each company. And I imagine some companies fared better than others.
What about the officers? Was there an officers' mess?
We did, in the just a small company officers' mess. I mean, there was a battalion headquarters officers' mess, and then in the companies there was only about two or three of us in each company, because at that time, of course, we had platoon sergeant majors. having as you heard previously, the cut back in officers coming to Sandhurst in 1938, they discovered they hadn't got enough of them. So they invented this rank of platoon sergeant major. It was a bit of a, I suppose Monty would call it a dog's breakfast, which everybody says now. It worked up to a point, but it when we got back to England and the officers came up, the octaves started pouring out of the octaves, it was abolished. But you can imagine you've got one platoon with an officer who's a commissioned officer, and you've got two platoons perhaps with platoon sergeant majors. They don't get the same pay as the officer. They don't have the same privileges as an officer. The sergeant major in charge in the company would call the officer in charge of the an officer, sir. He would then call his two platoon sergeant majors Fred or George, according to according to how well he knew them. But of course they weren't trained up to command. This was the point, and some of them were better than others. Some of them carried it off very well. But they came from platoon sergeants, And although the platoon sergeants were experienced men, they had an officer there who took the responsibility at the end of the day, so that they, although they were more experienced perhaps than the officer and would give advice and so forth, they then left it to their officer to make the decisions. So really, it wasn't a good idea. I don't know who thought it up. I had so many anomalies in it that when we got back to the UK, they just disappeared, and we got these OCTU officers coming in.
What happened to these platoon sergeant majors? Did they get commissioned, or did they revert back?
Oh, no, they couldn't all have got... I don't think they could all have got commissions. I don't know, they were warrant officer class 2, so presumably they were posted away and became sergeant majors of companies and so forth. Some of them may have gone up to a warrant officer class 1 RSM, for all I know. Because when we got back to the UK, of course, there was a tremendous expansion taking place, so they were needed.
How were sort of orders issued then when you were in this role? What did they come round in written form, or were you given them verbally at the beginning of the day's work?
Gosh, I can't remember. I'm sure we were told what time we had to be on the job. When we got there, we would get our instructions presumably from a sapper, because they would be in charge of the overall work. A lot of it was continuation work. I mean, we knew what we had to do the next day, because we hadn't finished what we were doing that day, so it was some of the work we were doing went on for a week or more.
Carrying on?
Yeah.
Mm. You mentioned that when you got back in the evenings, all you wanted to do was keep warm and get into bed and
yeah.
So on. Was there any entertainment or diversion available?
Yes, there was. Lille was the centre of... recreation, so forth in those days. There were clubs there. There were clubs for officers. There were canteens and clubs for the sergeants and men. A lot of it was run by WVS and people who come up from the UK. You see, the First World War hadn't been over all that long, so there was no doubt that they learnt a lot from what was necessary in the First World War, would be necessary again. And, I mean, we got daily papers and that sort of thing.
How did you get into Lille? Was there transport laid on?
Yes, recreational transport was laid on, so that you had to apply for it. You were allowed... I don't think you'd have it all the time. I think you were allowed one or two trips, probably one a week or something like that. And then you applied, and then the transport was provided. The only certain numbers were allowed to go in each time. I mean, so many per company when it came to soldiers. And then they'd all go to battalion headquarters and get into three tunners and be taken in. And then be brought back again, singing at the tops of their voices. So
Did you have any trouble with disorder or drunkenness?
No, I don't remember any. I'm sure some of them must have got drunk because they weren't used to the local... variety of drinks, but I certainly no dis. I don't remember. There might well have been disorders here and there, with a few at the end of the day picking a fight with one another, particularly between regiments in those days. But as far as we're concerned, I don't recall anything. I mean, you got the odd chap who went absent without leave when he went home on leave, didn't come back, that sort of thing.
What happened to those cases? How were they treated?
Well, they were given CB. It depends how long they'd been away. But, of course, as a company, you could only give 7 days CB as a company commander. So it was remanded for the commanding officer. Well, he could give up to, I think it was 28 days detention, if necessary. But I don't know what they'd... It depended entirely as to how long they were away and what excuse they had when they got back, and whether the excuse was valid.
I mean, it was often said that soldiers going absent without leave, particularly if they're regulars, normally there was some family trouble at the root.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, if there was, then it would be taken up. And the second in command of the battalion was the chap who usually looked after this sort of thing. And he would get in touch with people in the UK to go and see the family and see if anything could be done to help.
You mentioned also that one of your duties was censoring the mail. Was that a a regular occupation?
Oh, yes. I had to censor the mail of all my Patuan. And there was no guarantee, of course, that it wouldn't get opened again by a censorship further down the line. But you had to be very careful about censoring your soldiers' letters. You had to make sure that it went in one eye, so to speak, and came out of the other. Otherwise, you knew too much about them and began to look at them in a different way. So you had to sort of look at it totally impartially. And they didn't know enough, really, to put anything in there which would be of interest to the enemy, I'm sure of that. And I'm sure when writing to his mother at home, I don't think she was in touch with the Kaiser. So there was never very much. Then there was all these sort of codes on the back of the letter, sort of SWALK, sealed with a loving kiss, and other things like that, which you had to know about, but in case there was something there which they might have said where they were. That was really the only thing which I suppose could have been of interest to anybody at all. But there were enough fifth columnists, I think, walking about at that time in northern France to give a full order of battle to the Germans. I'm quite sure of that.
Did the soldiers mind having their letters read?
I never heard of anything. I think they just took it as being necessary. I mean, I had mine read by the company commander, although I signed on the outside of the envelope there, which I showed you, but he had to sign it off as well, so...
Did they write often? Was it a popular activity?
Oh, yes, they did when they could. There was plenty of mail going backwards and forwards. And, of course, I mean, we weren't far from London, from England, really. I mean, these days people hop across there and fill up with duty-free and back again. I mean, we were only just across the Channel. So mail didn't take any time at all.
So there was an easy flow both directions.
Oh, yes. Yeah, no problem. The only time I had trouble with mail was when I was on this ammunition train, and, of course, we were out of touch with everybody then.
You mentioned fifth columnists. Did you see any signs of fifth column activity or have any espionage scares while you were...
No, it was only afterwards that we realised what, you know, there was a bit, because some of the French, not all of them, but some of the French, and of course not all of them, but there were individual French who were sympathetic towards the Nazi cause. The only one we ever captured was later, after the balloon went up, we brought in a chap. And we thought he'd come down by parachute. And we took him into Bataillon headquarters, where the Bataillon IO spoke a bit of German. And he said, "Your shoes are undone," in German. And he looked down, and that one found out that he spoke German. Took his jacket and shirt and stuff off and found his parachute harness marks on his back. So he was marched off in double quick time. But that is the only one which... I know of. There was also this station master at Fortel, not the one I knew quite well, but another one there. When I went back there in 1944, as we were passing through, they said, "Oh yes, he was definitely a Nazi sympathizer." What sort of information they could have passed on, I don't know. I mean, we all had the regimental flashes on our arms. They all knew where we were. Where we're billeted and staying and so forth. I suppose they pass that back.
Yeah, I mean, one of the basic aims, surely, is establishing an order of battle, isn't it?
That's right.
Location and deployment of units and
yes.
so on. So
yes.
that kind of basic information
yes.
could be gathered by fifth
yeah.
columnists.
That's right. There was more of it, of course, in Belgium and Holland, because you've got, as you mentioned earlier, there's a Flemish element there, who were, many of them were more orientated towards the Germans than they were towards the French.
Did you have any preliminary invasion scares before the balloon did go up in May of 1940?
Yes, I seem to remember, I think we had two. The one I remember most was the one in December. But that really meant that all we did was to stand by. There was nothing more we could do.
Do you remember what the information was when the order came down?
I can't remember, except that there was talk of a build-up of German troops on the Belgian border, which they may have been doing just to see what we did, for all I know. But I remember being told that. And then we were put at short notice to move. So we had to load all the trucks up. Our 1,500 weight platoon, 1,500 weight, which we had, would have all the ammunition in it and greatcoats and that sort of thing for immediate use in the front.
What was the period of notice to move?
I wouldn't know. I couldn't remember. It must have been hours rather than days. Mm. We would have been confined. Not to barracks, but to billets.
Yes.
We would have been confined, so we could have moved at a very short notice.
And would you have been moving on foot, or would you have been moving in troop-carrying vehicles?
We would have been moving as we did in the event, in vehicles. Mm. But I don't think we got the troop carriers at that time. Mm. We would have been moving in three-tonners, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, provided by the RASC.
So it would be the RASC transport company that...
Yes.
Moved you.
Yes.
You had no organic.
No. We had no spare just for moving troops. Mm. I mean, we had the 1,500 weights, which were the sort of forward vehicles. Then we had the three tonners for all the administration behind. And then, of course, there were carriers and that sort of thing. But no, we didn't have any spare three transport for just moving.
So you mentioned you had a scare in December, and you said there was another one.
Yeah, I can't remember when it was, I'm afraid. I remember there was one. I remember two in my mind, but when it came, more likely, I should think, in the early spring, I should think. I think December was the first one. I think the second one probably came in the early spring.
Do you remember if you had any idea that you might be going forward into Belgium in the event of... Mobile operations.
I don't think so, no, because we were so involved in building all these defences and making up the roads and so forth. I don't imagine anybody would have told my level anyway. I suppose Bataan headquarters may have had an order which was sealed and not to be opened, that sort of thing, or brigade down to brigades, but not at my level. I wouldn't have known.
What happened to you then on the morning of the 10th of May? Do you remember how the day began and how it developed?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I could go back one day earlier than that. On the 9th of May,
yes.
I was sent down to with an advance party into the interior of France, into the countryside, where there was a big training area for the battalion to go down there and train. Probably it might have been sort of developed into brigade and divisional training later, for all I know. But at that stage, I was down there.
Do you remember where that was?
No, I don't. I know it was in the interior somewhere. I was in a billet. I was billeted there in a house. And the following morning on the 10th, I heard sort of unusual noises going on outside. And I looked out of the window, and I could see sort of aircraft flying, single aircraft flying at quite a height around, in not going in any direction, but circling around. And then there was little puffs of anti-aircraft shell, black puffs. It didn't seem to bear any relation to the aircraft, but they were there. And that was, at that time, whilst I was looking out of the window, of course, the Germans were pouring across the Belgian and Dutch borders, which I didn't know at that time. Anyway, we got the order soon later that day to return to the battalion. And, of course...
How did that arrive? Was it dispatch rider or telephone or some other means?
I couldn't remember. Of course, we had a telephone system in France at that time called Table A, which was Table A in English, which you got through to the... You picked up telephone, and this is if you were away from your unit, because within units you had the normal sort of... field telephone laid out to each company and so forth. You picked up the telephone and then you got through to the local civilian exchange, and all you had to say was Table A, and so she said, oh, another Anglais, you know, and sort of stuck us through to the military exchange, and then you asked for where you wanted to go. So presumably, I don't know how we got the message the other way around. Perhaps they sent a DR, I'd expect, with a message. Mm. It's the only way. Or we wouldn't have been in wireless touch, radio touch.
Do you have any idea of how far away you were?
Quite a long way, because we were down into the middle of France somewhere, I think, well away from the sort of what would have been the France borders.
So you got your order to return the battalion.
Yes. And the next thing I can remember is moving in a 3-ton lorry up into Belgium.
How did you get back to the battalion then?
Well, we had our own transport.
You had your own transport, so yes. You drove back to the battalion.
Yes.
Were they actually still in their location when you got back there?
Yes, they were still in the same place, yes, in Meschel.
So you drove back on the 10th. Mm. Do you remember the timings? You know, what sort of time you got back?
Not the faintest idea.
I mean, did the battalion move out on the 10th, or was it on
No,
the
we were waited 2 or 3 days, I think, before we actually moved, because we had to wait for transport.
Oh, yes.
So being corps troops, we didn't have a priority. Mm. They moved I suppose, 1st, 2nd, 3rd and 4th and 5th divisions out. Because they were going through Brussels and taking up their defensive position along the Dyle, Louvain, 15 miles east of Brussels, I think it was. So when the transport finally became available, then we got it and we moved.
Where did you move to? Do you remember the route that you took?
Yeah, vaguely, yes. We started off at night, and I can remember we went through Lille and places like Tournai on the border. And then when it became light, we found ourselves in Belgium. Mm. And the only thing I can remember about that trip, or two things I remember about that trip. One is that as we stopped somewhere, because it was very slow, we were very slow moving, some splendid lady came up and shoved a piece of bread and dripping through the cab window at me. That was my first experience of Belgian hospitality, I think. The next thing I remember is when we went through some of the towns, and I can't remember their names in Belgium, although the Germans were coming through across their borders, life was going on quite normal. The roads were crowded with transport, trams and lorries and cars. There were people sitting outside on the pavements and the cafes. Sun was shining and all was right in the world as far as they were concerned at that time.
What vehicle were you in? Were you in the?
I was in a 3-tonner. I was sitting in front of a 3-tonner with some of my platoon at the back. I don't think they got them all into one 3-tonner.
When you were doing this movement, you were moving at night. Presumably, you were moving without lights.
I suppose so. Yes. There were some things which you put over the headlights, which dimmed the lights considerably, or reduced the amount of beam. Mm. So they must have had some sort of areas. There must have been those on. Mm. We couldn't possibly have moved without lights in convoy.
Mm. Were you observing any sort of distance between vehicles?
Oh, yes. Yes, definitely. But I don't know how much at this time. Later, we used to move at 12 and a half miles in the hour or something, and then we'd stop for 20 minutes every 2 hours for a rest. That was the usual sort of convoy law, so to speak.
Do you remember if you had any idea of where you were going or what you were going to do when you set off? Had you been briefed when you got back to
Well, I suppose we must have done. I know we finished up in a point northwest of Brussels. And I can't remember, I'm afraid, the name of the place.
Yes.
And we were still on our own at that stage. Mm. It was just outside Brussels, northwest somewhere. Mm. And we stayed there for 2 or 3 days whilst the fighting was going on up front.
What sort of ground was it that you were deployed on there?
Well, we weren't actually deployed. We were just sort of concentrated there.
Just concentrated?
Yeah.
Were you in billets there, or were you outdoors?
Oh, God, I don't know. They might have put us in billets, because I don't think they were anticipating an immediate early withdrawal, which actually took place. At least I hoped that wasn't going to happen. So they might well have put us into billets, but I really can't remember. We were obviously put there as some sort of reserve. And we were there, as I say, for about 2 or 3 days.
Did you see any signs of air activity during that move forward and the time you were...
Not a thing. Brussels. No, it looked... It was almost as if the Germans were sort of waiting for us to come into the trap, so to speak, and making it easy for us. But we didn't realise at that time what was happening. But we had no German or Luftwaffe interference at all during that move up.
Did you have any information about what was going on in a more general sense?
No, I don't remember. I don't think so. You see, I was only a platoon commander in those days, bottom of the pile, so to speak. I don't remember at all. I'm sure we must have been told what the BEF as a whole was doing, which had gone up and was holding the front and the Dyle. We had our Belgians on the left and I think it was the French First Army on the right.
What sort of mood were the soldiers in then when they set off for this drive forward into Belgium?
I think they were fairly gung-ho. I mean, they weren't the sort of chaps who were sort of... They took everything in their stride, those chaps. No matter what happened, they just sort of accepted it and got on with it. I think they were glad something was happening after all this messing around and the phony war. But I can't say that they were all shouting, let's get to the front and kill the Boche or anything like that. Because they're not that type of people. They didn't, they just did their job. I don't think they had any animosity towards the Germans at that stage. Some of them did later when their houses got bombed in the east end of London, but they were just out there to do a job.
What happened then? So you were in this place for 2 or 3 days with nothing much going on. Did the logistics work? Did you keep, did the food and so on come up while you were...
Oh, yeah, there was no problem at that time. No problem at that time.
So far you'd had a sort of smoothish move forward.
Yes.
And you got into a location somewhere.
Well, it was a sort of concentration area.
Concentration area,
I suppose.
Not dug in or anything like that.
No.
And then...
Well, after about 2 or 3 days, I think it must have been about 3 days, we got an order to go forward and take up positions on the Charleroi Canal,
yes,
which ran, as you probably know, west of Brussels. Mm. So we moved there, and it must be about this time, I suppose, that the Belgians and the French were starting to withdraw. Otherwise, they wouldn't have required us to go there. We dug our positions along the canal.
Would this have been on the west bank of the canal?
On the west bank facing east, yeah.
Yes. What was the canal like at that point, and how long was your sector? Do you remember?
I can't remember. Well, my own sector was probably 200 or 300 yards, I should think. It was near a bridge, I remember that, one of the main bridges which came across from east to west. And of course there were a lot of civilians starting to come back across there. But nothing happened we were there for about a day, I suppose, before anything really happened.
How were you, said you were dug in.
Yeah.
Were you on the actual bank of the canal, or were you a bit further back?
I think we were further back a bit, not right down on the water's edge.
Yes.
So we get a good field of fire.
How was it laid out? How did you have the platoon? Did you have two sections forward and one back, or did you have...
I imagine I probably did. I can't honestly remember. I mean, that would be the logical thing to do, is to have two up and one back. Sometimes it wasn't possible, depending entirely what frontage you got. You may have to put all three up front. But I imagine that was probably what happened, yeah.
Do you remember what the view forward was like from those...
Oh, we could see right across the river, rather the canal, but across the other side there were buildings.
Yes.
That was Brussels. Mm. But they were quite, as far as I remember, they were quite far back. There was a sort of area between the canal and the buildings themselves, so there was probably a road there and... a sort of greensward or something.
And you had some field of fire then?
Well, we had a good field of fire down there. My main field of fire would have been down the canal itself if they started trying to get across, because that's when they'd be most vulnerable.
How wide was the canal at that
time? I really can't remember. Canals weren't all that wide, actually. I mean, it wasn't like a river.